The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hey, welcome to the podcast. It's Glenn, Stu. We've got a holy crap bomb that was planted by the New York Times. I mean, holy crap. What have they found about Brett Kavanaugh this time? Well, he's practically Jack the Ripper.
Yeah. That's a fair characterization, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he's way beyond gang rapist.
Oh, God, those are the old days.
That's when we thought he was innocent.
Yeah.
You know? Okay, so he gang raped a bunch of women.
Right.
Big deal.
This is much beyond that.
This is way beyond that. And so we talk a little bit about Brett Kavanaugh and what is happening, what's going to happen next. And I lay out a few scenarios, four or five of them, that foreshadow what I think the possibilities are, because I do think the Jeff Flakes or the Susan Collins, there's a chance they peel away on things like he lied.
Right. And, you know, the point is not to abandon Brett Kavanaugh if you think he's a good justice. It's the idea of be prepared for every eventuality. That's your job in government. It's your job as we look at these big issues. And I hope that that's happening right now behind the scenes.
I hope it is, too. I have a feeling it's not. Our advice to President Trump, who is the only president that would have stood by this guy for this long, and I'm thrilled that he did. He's got some spine. If the Republicans cave, I think it's going to spell real trouble for them. But we'll talk about that a little bit more. Also, a year later, the anniversary of the Vegas shooting, a year later, what do we really know? We tell the story of one of the potential victims and how a baby saved their life. That's coming up, all on the podcast.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program. It's Tuesday, October 2nd. Glenn Beck.
You know, there's always two sides of a coin. For every benefit of technology, there is another side. There's a dark side. Take social media and the internet. Before that existed, journalists had a stranglehold on the mass flow of information and opinion. If you wanted to have a voice, you had to go through your local newspaper, your local news, cable news, national publications like the New York Times. Your voice, really, the only place your voice could be heard in the past was on talk radio. But social media has changed all of that. And now you've got a hot take, or, you know, maybe you just saw some breaking news, and you can instantly publish and blast that information out into the entire world. Good. Except there's a flip side to that coin. Let's say you work at a news outlet, supposed to be impartial. Well, anything you've ever blasted out on the interwebs is instantly available to check your impartiality or your non-biased bona fides. Let me give you an example. New York Times. Emily Bazelon. July 9th, she tweeted, quote, As a Yale Law School graduate and a lecturer, I strongly disassociate myself from tonight's praise of Brett Kavanaugh. With respect, he's a fifth vote on the hard right turn on voting rights and so much more that will harm the democratic process and prevent a more equal society. Okay, so in July, she came out and she let everybody know, I'm against him. I think he's dangerous. Now, that was just 3 months ago. She exercised her ability, as we all do, to share with the world what our opinions are. And then yesterday, she shared with the world her independent viewpoint. Emily exercised the other platform she has, the New York Times, with a holy crap bombshell on Brett Kavanaugh, and I hope you're buckled in for this, or it's just sincerely. The allegations are horrifying. You'd ask yourself, what could be worse than attempted rape, Glenn? Well, gang rape. Yeah, but what could be worse than gang rape? Well, here we go. Emily in the New York Times reported that in September of 1985, Brett Kavanaugh threw a glass of ice at somebody. Yes, yes. I'm sorry if this is a triggering event for you. If you're all of a sudden like, you remember somebody coming at you, Jack Frost, trying to stab you with the icicles. I get it. I'm sorry I had to bring this up. The New York Times is reporting on ice throwing. Now, I heard this story originally from the New York Times. I listened to a podcast, The Daily, which I don't recommend. I listened to it so you don't have to. But I listened to it this morning. And in that report, and, you know, he went to jail. And I thought, he went to jail? You'd think that would have come up. No, he didn't go to jail. There were no arrests made. The charges were not filed. Nothing. Neither of those things happened. Police were called because they got into a fight. And the police said, okay, all right, knock it off. Now go home. Oh, well, we can't have somebody like that on the Supreme Court, can we? When he was in college, he was in a bar and some guy said something to him and he threw ice on him and the police were called and the police said, hey, knock it off, go home. I mean, what kind of madman, what kind of Jack the Ripper are we putting on the Supreme Court? Thank you, New York Times. This story does not live up to even the editorial standards of the New York Times. Someone threw ice in 1985. Really? God forbid you ever go to Philadelphia. Now, Emily, the writer of this story, her tweets make it obvious that she's opinionated against Brett Kavanaugh. So now the New York Times has been caught publishing a supposed journalist being an activist. And this is not a mistake. How did this story get through the editorial staff? Well, easy. I believe they're probably activists as well. They're activists, and this just goes to show his temperament. He might, you know, somebody might come in and say, hey, I'm fighting for abortion in the court. And he might just take a glass of ice and throw it at that person. Get used to it, America. We have a full week of this as we get closer to the vote. The ridiculousness escalates to a full-on clown show, probably by this afternoon. Now, a clown show in the media, leading up to a circus in the Senate. You know what? I guess nothing has changed. But this time, can I at least get some cotton candy?
It's Tuesday, October 2nd. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
All right. So, Stu.
I'm a little disturbed, but all right.
I know. The goalposts, man, they just keep moving them. I mean, they must be tired, don't you think?
They're heavy. The goalposts are getting heavier
and heavier and heavier,
and heavier because there's a lot. If the farther you move them, the harder it is to justify. This is incredible. Though I am very disturbed, of course, by these new allegations against Brett Kavanaugh that he threw frozen water at someone. Frozen water, first of all, can be sharp. It can be heavy. You know what? People are like, oh, that's not a big deal. So what? He threw ice. Frozen water can't be dangerous. Tell that to the people of Peru, where 22,000 people were killed in an avalanche in 1970. Tell it to those people. Tell it to those families.
See, this is why he's not on the Supreme Court. Look at his temperament. You don't have the temperament to be anywhere near that microphone, Mr. Breguir.
I do have the temperament to be on the Avenatti team, however.
Oh, yeah, of course you do.
I can jump right into that role.
Oh, yeah, dead dogs have that.
They spent, Glenn, 15 minutes on this bar fight on CNN this morning. 15 minutes where they talked about how, look, it's certainly on its own. This is their fairness. On its own, it would not be disqualifying. Oh, really? A bar fight in which he's not charged or arrested with anything, and the accusation is he threw ice on someone, wouldn't disqualify him 40 years later for the Supreme Court? Thanks for all the wonderful the room you're giving him. What leeway. But here is a situation where they're just like, well, but what it does say, What it does say is that it plays into a larger picture of this man. He was in his anger when he was drinking, and this shows that he's capable of doing these things.
So if he
I've never seen anyone reach further.
I know. If he would have come on and he would not have been angry, I would have thought something was up. Because nobody does that to me, my family. Nobody is going to make those charges and smear my name without me at least responding forcefully. And if you don't like the anger, I want you to hear me clearly. I did not have sexual relations.
With that woman.
Same thing.
Oh, yeah.
He looked and they praised him for being angry about it. They praised him for his forcefulness. You could tell the president was angry. He wants to get back to the business of the American people. So no matter what he did, it would have been a problem. They keep moving the goalposts. Now, here is my plea to Donald Trump. First of all, I don't believe any other president in my lifetime, with an exception of Reagan, and I'm not even sure Reagan would have done it. No other president in my lifetime would have stuck with Kavanaugh all the way through those hearings. There's no way they would have said the cost is too high. They just wouldn't have done it. So, A, points for Donald Trump for having a spine and going, this is garbage. B, we're in this situation now, and if there is nothing, if there's ice fights, don't give up the ship. Do not move, because if you move now, they are going to do this every single time, and you cannot give any ground. With that being said, and I don't think this is a chance at all, if those charges turn out to be right, you notice the media is not furthering the Ford testimony. They're no longer on that.
Yeah. Nobody's seem like it's she's been abandoned already.
Right. She's done. She served her purpose. She bought time. They used her as a pivot to something new. Okay? So there's nothing new there. There's nothing new. Or the press would be saying, well, you watch what's going to come out in this FBI. They're not saying that. Nobody has come out and said, you know what? I was so offended by how forceful he was, and I wasn't going to say anything, but I know that that happened. None of that is happening. What is happening is people are saying, you know, I was for him and I wasn't going to say anything. But as soon as he started to say he was an altar boy, I remember him drinking. So that's what's coming now. And they're going to go after perjury. You watch. That's by the end of the week. That's what they'll be talking about. If Donald Trump, please, Donald Trump, the only chance you have and the only chance the Republicans have, if this thing goes awry in any way, you have to have a plan and announce it in the same press conference that you say, you know, he quit, or
the vote went down
and it burned
against,
down, whatever right.
it is,
that press conference, you must say, and here's my next nominee, and we're going to have it done before the election. Now, in my opinion, the only one that can stand that is Mike Lee, because you don't need, how long did it take to do the Jeff Sessions vote?
Oh, I mean, he brought in January 20th, he was inaugurated, and then February 8th, the vote went down.
So 4 weeks.
Yeah, three, four weeks. You know, probably could have been faster, he had other things going on.
Okay, so you have 4 weeks to do it. That's what you have now for the election. You have 4 weeks. the one who can get that, the one who doesn't need all the FBI checks and all of that is Mike Lee. It's already been done. He's
the only
senator.
One who can get done that quickly.
Yeah, he's the only one that can be done that quickly, or another senator, but Mike Lee is the guy.
And Mike Lee's the only senator on the list.
Yes.
So
you've got Mike Lee. You could select him. Let's just say Brett Kavanaugh is hit by a plane tomorrow. Which I wouldn't.
A strange accident, but it could happen. I guess it happened in Indiana Jones, and one of them were the guy where they were fighting on the tarmac.
Oh, yeah,
and the plane was turning around. If that happens to Kavanaugh,
well, this one they won't be delivering the Ark in that plane. They'll be delivering the New York Times in that plane. But anyway, so let's just say, and it makes him into sausage. Mm-hmm. You need to announce that Mike Lee is the candidate. We are going to have this done by the election. They're, of course, going to go crazy because Mike Lee is uber pro-life, and he would vote.
Well, I mean, the bottom line is he cares about the Constitution more than anything.
He will vote. He will vote the Constitution, and he will also vote for right of life. He's not going to go in there with an agenda, but he is a right-to-life guy. So Kavanaugh wasn't good enough. Here's Mike Lee. There's no drinking parties with Mike Lee. There's just no drinking party. Maybe. And it'll be like, Mike is like, all right, I confess, I tasted beer in 1983. I didn't really like it, but I tried it.
It was root beer. Have you heard of this root beer?
Root beer. Mm-hmm. So anyway, he's the only one that you could push through. Because if you don't have a plan immediately, then the Democratic plan works of delay.
Yeah, and that's the most important point. Their strategy is not to say that Kavanaugh is a sexual abuser. Their strategy is not to say anything about Kavanaugh specifically. Their strategy is to delay this thing so they can get to the election, and if they get past the new Senate coming in, they can potentially have a chance of stopping this. Now, if you were to, the day after this goes down, God forbid, they find something terrible.
Let's say they find something terrible about him,
right? And everybody agrees. And it goes down 80-20, right? Like, it's just one of those things they found something terrible about Kavanaugh. We don't think that's going to happen. However, you must be prepared for that potentiality. You have to be ready for it. And if you tried to go down the other suggested road that we talked a little bit about yesterday, which was, a Diane Sykes or, an Allison Eyde or one of the other.
You won't make it to January. You won't.
You could potentially have enough time before they seat the Senate. But I mean, it's going to be really close and you might not make it. Mm-hmm. Lee is the only thing you'd be able to get that through fast enough.
Lee also is the guy that everybody in the Senate has to look at after they voted against. I mean, they will vote against.
Yeah, the Democrats will still do it. But would Jeff Flake vote against, Mike Lee?
I just don't think so.
I don't think so. These people have good relationships with Lee, even though they think he's too conservative for them.
And remember, it's advise and consent. Now, I know the Democrats won't care about that, but there's a chance that you can get all of the Republicans on board. If you don't, I want to lay out some scenarios of what we're looking at here, and please help me with the good scenario. I'll lay out five or six scenarios for you when we come back on what is headed our way.
The best of the Glenn Beck program.
All right, I want you to think of some scenarios on how this ends and the right way to deal with all of it and what it means to the future. We'll give those to you here in a second. We want to go over some of the things that people now are saying about Brett Kavanaugh, and not the ridiculous stuff. I'd rather focus on two things. This extra week was to find out if the Ford thing was real. I don't think that's real. If it is real, if they come up with credible evidence that it's real, he's out. You agree with that, Stu?
Yeah, I mean, I think if somehow they were able to prove that he did something or really make you believe he did.
Yeah, I mean, if it's credible evidence, if it is preponderance of evidence.
Yeah, if the details matter, but yes, generally speaking, yes.
Okay. Perjury. this is what they're going for now. This is what Jeff Flake has bought. And what he purchased was an extra week for the media and the Democrats to move the goalposts. And now the goalposts are moving. The goalposts now are, did he perjure himself? Did he lie under oath? And not about Professor Ford, but about what was written in his yearbook.
Hmm.
So here are the things that they are saying. And you have to say, is this, would this rise to the level of perjury? All right, go ahead.
And I want to warn you, we are about to use highly technical medical terms. And if you are, this maybe go a little bit over your head, that's okay. Stick with us.
Okay.
Judge Kavanaugh's yearbook page included the entries, Judge, have you boofed yet?
Have you boofed yet?
And Devil's Triangle. On Thursday, he said boofed meant flatulence and that the Devil's Triangle was a drinking game in which three glasses were arranged in a triangle. This is disputed, according to the New York Times. And I want to make sure that you understand that I'm reading from what is supposedly the greatest newspaper ever created. They are talking about whether the word boofed means flatulence or not. Boofed in the 1980s was a term that often referred to technical terms, anal sex. And this is how Judge Kavanaugh's classmates said they interpreted his comment. They said they had never used it before as it referred to flatulence.
Okay.
Now, the term boofed, Glenn, mm-hmm. was a term that I do remember from my, I would say, elementary school days.
Oh, good. That was before Clinton.
Middle school, maybe? Yeah. I mean, it was like, I don't think I necessarily knew what it meant, but I feel like it had a sexual connotation to it. However, what I found is interesting is as I was talking to you about this morning before the show, and assuming that everyone would understand that as what it meant, you had a totally different understanding of the word.
Well, I wasn't the hippest, so
no right.
So
no,
I don't
one's
know.
Accused you of that.
But I seem to remember something. I don't recall, but I think we used to, you know, getting stoned or something. I can't remember
the
for
word
sure.
Boofed meant getting
you were
stoned
or getting stoned, something like that, maybe.
Okay,
Have you ever heard the term spleef?
Yeah, maybe
I think
in like
that was in
Richmond,
that kind
Fox
of that.
Times at Richmond High.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it's been a long time.
Right. Okay.
Okay. But I looked it up in the Urban Dictionary.
Okay.
Okay.
So this is this. I mean, this is as close as you can come to like a founding document of the word boofed.
Yes.
Right. This is like if you go back to the Federalist Papers about
yeah,
boofing.
The Urban Dictionary.
That's what.
Okay.
That's what this is.
The Urban Dictionary.
All right.
To abuse any licit or illicit substance via insertion into one's rectum.
That's the number one meaning.
That's the number one meaning.
I have never heard it used like that.
Butt funneling.
Okay.
Now, I don't
Again,
know
these are highly technical terms.
I don't know who says, you know what? I bet it's better if we drink beer through our butt. But apparently, that's been done.
I didn't know you could do that.
I didn't know you could do that either.
Is it?
I don't recommend.
And it's not called really drinking if you do it that way.
It's not.
We're learning here, boofing.
No. I don't know if you have butt blackouts, if, you know, all of a sudden your butt falls asleep. I'm not sure.
I'm not sure. Okay.
Okay. So there's the number one. The next one is something that is whack, dumb, or effed up. Used to describe objects, people, or stuff you don't want to do.
So that that guy's a boof?
That guy's a boof?
I feel like that's maybe also how I heard it, now that you're saying it that way. Because it was just kind of like an insult.
Yeah, that may have been, yeah.
Right?
I just don't, I remember the words, but I don't remember it connected to, you know, sticking things in. Anyway, here's one that kind of makes me feel a little better. A synonym for weed.
Okay, yeah. So, how would it, is there a sentence?
Smelled.
Use it in a sentence, please.
Smelled dat boof.
Now, I assume that's D-A-T is what you're saying.
Yes.
Smelled dat boof.
Yes,
okay, yes. That makes me feel uncomfortable.
Fifth, the act of lifting the bow out of a whitewater kayak while going over rocks, waves, or waterfalls.
What?
In order to launch over hydraulics or rocks.
This entry is sponsored by Cabela's.
Yeah.
Is that, what, I've never heard that before.
Boof. The low-toned noise a dog makes,
okay,
typically when they are suspicious or unsure of whether they should actually bark or not.
Now, I haven't heard a flatulence one, but I have heard many things related to the butt, which I think somewhat...
Poof, another term for having sex. That'd be in the butt, Bob.
Okay, so again, I think this is the interesting point here. They're trying to say this is essentially perjury. There's no way that's perjury to me. That is a bonkers claim. The idea that word probably meant different things at different schools, as mine and yours did, right? As there are seven different definitions on Urban Dictionary for it. Now, not just because flatulence didn't make it there does not mean that locally that was not the way people used it.
But you do have the problem of people in Georgetown Prep now starting to come out and saying, look, I was for him, and I don't think he did this Ford thing. But now that he was saying that this is what these words mean, come on, man. And that he was never really fall down drunk. Yeah, he was.
Okay, well, so we have that one, too. You want to go to this?
Yeah, go to the next one.
All right, this is, again, the list of potential perjury for Judge Kavanaugh. The next one is excessive drinking. Judge Kavanaugh portrayed himself in his testimony as enjoying a beer or two in high school and as a college student, but not as someone who often drank to excess during those years. I drank beer with my friends, end quote. Then this is disputed, is what they say in the Times. His statements are at odds with some of his classmates and how they remembered him. Nearly a dozen college classmates of Judge Kavanaugh said they recalled him indulging in heavy drinking, some saying... So now it's less than a dozen because some of them said heavy drinking. Some saying it was beyond normal consumption. Parenthetical here. To be sure, a smaller number of classmates said his drinking was unexceptional. So again, this is like judging yourself and how much you drink is notoriously difficult, as I would assume a Mr. Alcoholic over here would be able to tell you. I mean, the whole point is the toughest thing to do is admit you're an alcoholic, right?
Yeah.
It's very possible, and I would say likely, that most people who drink to excess in these periods would not necessarily say that they're doing something abnormal, even if they are.
Here's how I take this. I took that testimony when I watched him talk about drinking. It was very clear that he was getting drunk. And he said,
right.
Look,
and
we
said,
all
drank to excess.
We drank to excess. We all did. Haven't you done that? I mean, on the drinking thing, I don't consider this a problem because I believe that he was, in effect, saying, yeah, but there is a difference between a blackout, okay? And maybe he had blackouts and didn't remember them. I don't believe that at all. You have a blackout, you remember it. You don't remember what happened.
You remember that you blacked out.
But you remember you were like, oh, crap, I don't even remember. Now, maybe at 17, you know, you're like, oh, that was so crazy. I don't even remember that. Maybe you're at 17 and doing that, but you have to consume a lot of alcohol.
Can I bring my expert witness?
Yes.
And Glenn Beck, please come to the stage. You know, to me, I'm going to make it a generalization, but with a specific accusation. 95% of people who say they drank to the point of blacking out are lying. I believe it's 95%. I believe that blackouts do exist, but it is extraordinarily rare. I just spent a week in France, which I can't believe my liver returned with me. I thought for sure it was going to be like, you know what? I'm staying on the beach here.
Right.
I drank a lot.
I would think
there.
That it would have been saying, I got to get back home. I got to dry out.
My point, though, is that I've had a lot to drink in my life at certain times. Yeah. I've never even been remotely
the
close to something I would consider.
The amount of alcohol that you have to consume in a very short period of time. Mm-hmm. Now, I've done my homework on it, and it's not exactly the way I have experienced it. Apparently, you can have blackouts if you drink an enormous amount of alcohol. If you were boofing, maybe. if an enormous amount of alcohol gets into your bloodstream quickly, you can black out. I have read places where they say it's rare. Some places say it's common. I'm sorry, but I do not believe. I believe it's a movie trick that most people, you know, they're like, oh, we did what last night? We had sex? No way.
Right.
Shut up.
95% of the time.
95%, that's a lie.
I had a friend who had drank a lot in a very short period of time and blacked out, fell off a stage and had to go to the hospital. And that was a legit, this is in college.
Yeah.
And that was a legitimate, like, he drank way too much. Nothing, he didn't do anything wrong. He just fell off the stage and almost killed himself.
And didn't remember any of it.
And just remembered being there, but did not remember the falling or anything.
Okay.
And so I'm not saying it never happens, but like the idea that you would say to someone, oh, this guy's lying, he did blackout, is completely absurd. You can't, you cannot accuse someone of lying about that. Only they would know if it occurred.
You can say that, and this is what they are saying, that he lied because he said, you know, he gave the impression that he wasn't ever out of control falling down drunk. Well, okay, I don't believe that, but I also don't, I wasn't left with that impression.
No, he said, I mean, the quote is, I drank beer with my friends. Almost everyone did. Sometimes I had too many beers. Sometimes others did. I like beer. I still like beer, but I did not drink beer to the point of blacking out. He just said I didn't black out. He didn't say he didn't drink to excess. In fact, he said, I have drank to excess. And, you know, I mean, I am not a big drinker in my life, but I've drank to excess several times. But never, I mean, the idea that getting to blackout drunk, yeah, you're maybe a different story, but getting to blackout drunk is, I mean, you've told me some of the levels of alcohol you've had in your life. The levels are almost inhuman. Like, I would definitely be dead.
Yeah, you're dumping poison into your system.
And
your
body a lot of it.
Your body can't handle. A blackout is shutting your body down, saying, I can't keep you alive and run all of these other systems.
Right.
I mean, that's you know, that's intense.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck Program.
Like listening to this podcast? If you're not a subscriber, become one now on iTunes. And while you're there, do us a favor and rate the show.
You know, I was thinking about it the other day. I was watching CNN and I saw three former Blaze employees sitting there, and I thought, I have been so blessed to work with some amazing, amazing people, you know, when they were young and before they got famous. And it's I don't know, it's really satisfying. One of the guys that I think of often, and I have no idea why I let him walk out the door, but I think I would have had to block it with my own body, which he wouldn't have been able to move, but... because he went to go become one of the founders of the Federalist, which is a great group of thinkers online. He has just written a book called First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Guns. And his name is David Harsanyi. Hi, David. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
You bet. So
I appreciate it. You're a bigger guy than people think or know.
thank you for that. I think it was a fat joke.
Well, I mean that in a good way.
Yeah. David, before we go into your book here, just give me a minute on your take on Kavanaugh and what's going to happen.
I think he's going to get through. And I think this is one of the ugliest smears we've seen, and at least in my life, covering politics and thinking about politics. And I think it's going to backfire in that it's really brought together most of the never Trumpers and all the sort of disparate parts of the right, and rightly so. And if not, I was listening to you before, I think that Trump has to be ready for that, and they have to push through someone else, because the courts, especially when you have a divided political environment as you do today, the Supreme Court's incredibly important. And you know, there's a rightful seat there for a conservative, and Trump should do what he has to do to get it through.
What do you think about Mike Lee? As everyone knows him, you don't need the FBI. You could vote in a week.
I love the idea. I mean, and you know, he's not going to like wander off.
No.
He's hardcore, so I'd be very happy with that. Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about your book. The thing I like about your book is that you do not shy away from America's gun culture.
Yeah, I think we talk a lot about the politics of guns, and obviously it's important, the ideology behind it. But I think a lot of people miss the culture behind it, the hundreds of years of embedded culture, not just in war, but in commerce, and in just the individual lives of Americans, and how important it was, and how that is in our DNA. And that's why we talk about guns the way we do. So, because I grew up in New York, and guns were sort of alien to my, you know, neighborhood and place I grew up, unless criminals had them. I thought it was important to try to figure out what that was about. And, you know, that's what the book's about.
Wow. So how did you, I mean, what did you find? I didn't know that you were you know, not part of the gun culture. I grew up in the gun culture, if you will. My grandfather and my uncles, we, you know, they'd go hunting and fishing, and we always had guns around. And it takes on a different meaning to me and to people who grew up around them. What'd you find?
Right. I mean, you know, where I grew up, if you mentioned guns or if someone had a gun, they'd immediately think about it in a negative way, not in something that would be positive. So, you know, just a personal story. My dad had a little jewelry store in New York, and it was robbed. And right after that, my dad tried to get a gun. And it was this, you know, this painstaking process of trying to get one to protect your own property and your own work and your own family. So that's, I think, when I started turning towards, you know, having a curiosity about what it was about. And then when I moved to Denver and lived in Colorado and other places, I saw what it was really about and how people treated it and how, like, an NRA member is the most responsible person on earth, you know, when it comes to guns.
So,
and I don't know if that people...
No, they don't understand that at all. Take me through some of the stories that you talk about, because what I like about this is it's not a gun. This is not a book about, you know, necessarily the laws and everything else. This is a story about America and how... We we're unlike any other nation on earth when it comes to guns in our history. Take me through, like, either Sam Colt or Buffalo Bill, two of my favorites.
Well, Sam Colt's just one of the most amazing Americans that ever lived. I mean, not only was he an engineer and just created this incredible innovation where a person went from firing one, you know, musket shot once a minute or maybe twice a minute to shooting five times in mere seconds. He was also just an innovator in marketing, in selling himself, in using the press to sell to other people, and using engineering to create something that he can make cheaper so the normal American, the normal man, the normal woman can get their hands on it. And it changed the West. It changed the way that the relationship a person has with a weapon. And he also had, he was, before Henry Ford, he was using interchangeable parts. It was like the first industrial revolution. So he was just an amazing man, and almost, it was my favorite chapter to write. I think he needs, more, we need a
full was a good
book
chapter
on him. Yeah.
So here we are at the 1 year anniversary of Las Vegas and the shooting of Las Vegas. Did you, in your looking through history, did you ever find another time in American history, and I should say, you know, pre-progressive, where guns had been viewed in America as anything but good?
No, I sort of actually, you know, in the 19th century, guns were sort of idealized and romanticized in books and things of that nature. It wasn't until the 30s, really, when anyone started to think about, and for some good reason, people were running around with machine guns shooting up places, in Chicago and elsewhere. So, I mean, there was a legitimate fear that some people had. But before that time, no one even thought to limit gun ownership in any way. I mean, certain places in the West, maybe they had certain areas where you couldn't have a gun because everyone was drunk and fighting, but generally no one had to go and ask the government, the state, for a gun. I think, in fact, that when you think about the Second Amendment, how you think about the ideals behind it tells us a lot about how you think about freedom in general. I think you're pretty authoritarian if you think that the individual shouldn't be able to defend themselves and rather should rely solely on the state.
Because you could have... you could have had a Gatling gun. I think you can still buy a Gatling gun legally, but you could buy a Gatling gun, but we didn't have those, you know, the mass shootings. One, it's a little harder to conceal a Gatling gun in a violin case, but also because the government's prohibition of alcohol led to the formation of these huge, terrible, and powerful mobs.
Yeah, and you know, they use Tommy guns, and you see them in the movies, and you know, it's kind of it's fictitious only in that the gun has big blowback, and it's not that easy to shoot, and it was almost never really used in criminal activities. It was more scaremongering by people who wanted to ban them. Now, I'm not saying people should have Tommy guns and driving around in their cars, but I'm just saying
I am.
Yeah,
I'm okay with that. If you're a responsible citizen, I'm fine with that.
That's true. Well,
so David. When we worked together, how long ago was it? 10 years ago?
Ooh, I don't know.
Yeah,
almost.
Yeah. Wow. So 10 years ago, if I would have said to you, in your lifetime, do you think there will be a serious move that either comes close or does take away America's right to guns? You would have thought that was a crazy question, if I'm not mistaken. Don't you think? 10 years ago.
Actually, yeah, I do. But I do feel better about the Second Amendment than I do the First, the Fourth, the Fifth, and others.
Yeah.
And,
right.
Because there are 400 million guns out there, and I think that the people who are part of the culture that I'm writing about and talking about will not hand them over that easily. So I'm less worried about them than I am certainly the First Amendment, I think, foremost, but others as well.
Well, you lose the Second, and you definitely lose the First.
I wonder
what it's going to take before people wake up to the road that we're sadly on. The name of the book is First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History of the Gun. It is a great read. It's David Harsanyi, First Freedom. It's out today. You can get it at Amazon or wherever books are sold. David, thanks so much.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program. And don't forget, rate us on iTunes.
I am not one to issue trigger warnings, but this particular sound has triggered one person. She says that she gets this awful feeling like she's about to fall off a cliff. She says, as soon as I hear helicopters, I fall back into that nightmare. She even got the feeling one time while watching American Ninja Warrior because it was filmed in Las Vegas. So it's American Ninja Warrior in Vegas. It's helicopters and some of her favorite music. In fact, her favorite, she cannot listen to. Jason Aldean. Her name is Mega Panzera. She said that even when she passes a food truck, that night will come back, crashing intensity that engulfs her. She's in the middle of the panic and she can hear the gunshots, one after another, after another, after another. Like the sound that little boys make for machine guns, she said. She can see the faces of the people as they sprint toward her. Some of them fall, some of them don't get back up. She can smell the crisp desert air of October in Las Vegas. The aroma of food fanning out of the food trucks with their motors that are usually so loud, stinking with beer that people dropped as they ran. She can hear the screams. The screams for her that never seem to stop. And the feedback from the guitars flung onto the stage and abandoned. Yet despite all of that, the engulfing terror of that feeling, it only takes one sound to bring her back. It's this sound. The tiny cry of her baby, her son, her hero. Megan went to the Route 91 Harvest Festival. It was October 1st, 2017, a country music festival that became the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history. For Megan, though, it all started as a date with her then-boyfriend, Valdo Panzera Jr. He was from New Jersey. He was in for the weekend to visit her in Las Vegas. She was working there as a teacher. They had been looking forward to the weekend for a while. No stress. They were just going to go see some, you know, music, have some food, have a great time together. Some of their favorite country musicians, they were all there for that same weekend, and they talked about it. And more each day, they got excited. But when the day finally arrived, Megan felt a little gutted. She was exhausted. She really wanted to go, but she had been feeling sick a lot lately. So the morning of that concert, they went to the doctor. And by fate, that morning, they found out that she was pregnant. She and Valdo were going to be parents. She said it was a strange realization to have. She said, given the setting, and it happened so fast, and I didn't expect it, that maybe it didn't fully kick in. Either way, she was now tired and pregnant, And she had plenty of excuses to skip the up-close festival experience and, you know, just go sit in the bleachers at the back. But the passes weren't cheap. Something deep inside of her, she says now, kept telling her it was the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do. Go. She's returned to that assurance. That assurance that put her in the bleachers. The view and the sound wasn't very good. She had paid for great spots. But she thought, this would be a better place for me. It'll be a little more relaxing. I'll be back from the crowd. I can watch them enjoy themselves. And we're all together, after all. There they were, sitting in the bleachers, not where they had paid to be. And then around 10 o'clock that night, during Jason Aldean's performance, it happened. So many things happened. Too many things happened all at once. So many things at once that they continued to replay all the different things, one at a time to this day. It started with confusion. The firecrackers that turned into machine gun barrage. The screams. They said they couldn't believe that all the screams just kept going, all of it. Imagine the panic they felt as 20,000 people turned around all at once and started running directly at them. Everyone ran. Everyone was just trying to stay alive to protect themselves or someone near them. The bullets were falling like hail in a tornado. They looked down as the bullets were falling right where they would have been if Megan hadn't been so tired and pregnant and hadn't listened to her voice inside. So their seats at the back saved them, or as they see it, their son saved them. Because from the back, they were able to quickly escape. Although as they sprinted to safety, Valdo felt a whip of air pass his head as a bullet flew past. It was close, and he knew what that meant. He said, "That was the moment I realized I have a family. I've got to do what I've got to do to keep them safe." And he's done just that. It was a moment that redefined him, or at least strengthened a part of him that he had been putting aside for later. Megan left Las Vegas and joined Valdo in New Jersey. Several months after the shooting, they got married in a gazebo. They did it in front of a body of water called Bueller's Pond, at a park near their home, in a procession led by their mayor. They didn't have a reception. They just went out for dinner. They didn't have a honeymoon, because they thought it was more important to focus on their baby so he would be born healthy, to keep him safe, like he had kept them safe. A few months later, just 8 months after the shooting, he was born. They both say now that when they hold him, they feel the weightlessness of new life. They've become immune to the dark moments they lived. They say they feel hope. The flashes of dark thoughts are still there. Megan says she feels a sudden anxiety when she thinks about her son's first day of school. "I don't know. I don't want to hold him back. I want him to have fun, but the world is just so different now." Valdo knows that. Like everything they've gone through, like all that they've seen and felt and heard, all the dangerous moments they barely escaped. It's just a matter of time. The world is different, yes. But time is not. Who knows what their son will be like when the day arrives for him to walk into the classroom alone. Only time will tell, his father says. For now, time is fragmented. It's kind of cruel sometimes. Megan and Valdo are still painfully aware of their environments everywhere they go. Things you didn't have to think about before, you have to think about now. It's just different. It's different, and we're raising him in a different world. It's really scary, Megan said. When she gets the feeling that everything is just so much larger than her, it's the world,
how the world has changed into something explosive and scary. Open spaces bring that feeling on, that lights in your eyes, panic. Something else happens. They haven't been to a concert since that day. They say even going to the mall is enough of an obstacle. But any time they're swarmed by that feeling, it goes away the minute they look at their son or they listen for his tiny sounds. He is the future, and they see the future that he will bring. Faldo's now a dispatcher for the local police department, member of a nearby high school district school board, and in both positions, he is able to affect change in many ways, change that could save his son, could save anyone's son from nightmares like his and Megan's. Because at the heart of it, nightmares of that kind are nightmares that we all feel. They're all of ours. 851 injuries, 59 deaths. We see the numbers, we see the frantic cell phone footage, and it's all too easy to succumb into that debilitating feeling like Megan and Faldo have. But just look for the tiniest things. Look for the tiniest sounds. Look for the stories like theirs. Listen for hope, because it is there. Much more than we even realize.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.